Lancelot, first of all, I wanted to ask about the relationship between the kind of the movement builders and the trolls. Because you described it as kind of a division of labor, but I think that it breaks down in a slightly more complex way, right? And I know you were trying to be brief, but like, if you read Andrew Anglin's story of how he became a Nazi, this is the webmaster of like the main Nazi site. When he started his first Nazi website, he didn't even realize that there were like Nazi political parties in the United States. He had come out of this like this troll environment where basically it starts with one person says the most extreme thing they can think of, and somebody tries to mash that. If you grew up in a punk scene, you know this very well. And pretty soon you've created a space where actual national socialists can come in, they can pass, right, and they can begin to do their recruiting. And so there seems to be not only an interesting kind of cross-pollination between the troll world and the movement world, the troll world also giving them most of their cultural figures, their memes, their Pepe, their like, there's an impressively long lexicon of different terms, which I would encourage people to learn about because they operate in plain sight. But also there's a fundamental antagonism, I think, between the trolliness and the movement builders. And you see that in the doxes that you were talking about, which if what I read was correct, a lot of those doxes actually came from Troll World. Where basically like, and I read this kind of chilling message on 8chan that said, you guys thought that we cared about building a national socialist movement? We want to fucking destroy everything. We'll destroy you too. We don't even care. And they were posting the names and addresses of all these big Nazi figureheads. If you were somebody who actually cared about a national socialist movement, you wouldn't do that, right? And I'm sorry, I'll wrap very quickly with that. I've been watching the way that these people have been disrupting the He Will Not Divide Us live stream, which if you don't know, is this anti-Trump art exhibit at the Museum of the Moving Image, where people just go and they mindlessly chant, "He will not divide us, he will not divide us," over and over again. It's the most vacuous political statement I've ever seen in my life. And these alt-right people are having a field day going up there and just fucking with these people and fucking with, it's kind of like alt-right neo-situationism, right? And I was watching this, I hate to say it, I was watching...
We'll do a glossary at the end, okay?
I was watching, very quickly, I watched Emily Eustis go up there, and she was fucking with these people, and she whipped them into a fervor, and she got everybody dancing and singing, and she yells, "White power," at the end. And I thought, how did it come to be that we're not the people fucking with the normies? Right, like, how did we cede this ground that they are the ones fucking with the mindless sheep instead of us? You know, so that's, I'll leave that to the crowd.
Very eloquent.
What's the doxy?
I have a question. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Oh yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Okay. First of all, I wanted to ask Matthew if you have any insight into why even Nazis, even neo-Nazis like Milo, can be defended with this sort of liberal, you know, freedom of speech type thing, and to where it would be controversial to attack him or to try to break up his speech, whatever, at Berkeley. And then, what do you have to say about, like, provocateurism? Like, if somebody wanted to infiltrate the Black Bloc, and how would we defend against something like that?
Well, you know, the issue of sort of how liberals position themselves relative to Nazis and far-rightists engaging in public speaking, I mean, it's an issue that's been around for decades. I mean, some people remember when the Nazis wanted to march in Skokie. What was that in 1970s, right? You know, and there was controversy about, you know, the ACLU supporting them in, you know, getting a permit and being able to march through a mostly Jewish neighborhood in Illinois. So, you know, I don't see it as anything, it's not like a new departure for there to be liberals defending Yiannopoulos speaking. So I'm not sure I have a lot to say about that specifically. I mean, I think that it's possible to make a an argument within a liberal framework that, you know, I mean, I think it's a, you know, it's not a ploy, it's a real argument that, you know, freedom of speech is about the government not cracking down on speech. It's not about, you know, people have the right to speak on any platform, anywhere. So, I mean, I definitely would not support efforts to get the government to crack down on Yiannopoulos or, you know, anybody on the far right in terms of, you know, you can't speak or you can't publish your views, because that approach, you know, too often has a boomerang effect. You know, it's the left that ends up suffering more anytime we take that approach. But that's very different from the question of how do we, as, you know, non-state actors, respond when people are not only, you know, just sort of stating their views, but engaging in campaigns which are directly about fomenting violence and fomenting attacks on people. And I forgot what the second question was. I'm sorry.
The provocateurs.
Provocateurs. Yeah. Provocateurism. Right. Well, it's tricky. I mean, people may have seen, was it Robert Reich had the article recently saying that, you know, maybe the Black Bloc was really provocateurs as a whole, supporting, you know, people working for Trump and trying to discredit the left. And I you know, I mean, there's no basis or evidence for that. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, there's a need for movement security. There's a need for people to, you know, get to know each other and just, you know, follow basic precautions as far as who you work with and so on. But there's also a need to not engage in just kind of reckless accusations and claims that, oh, well, you know, somebody's doing something suspicious, so maybe they're working for the government. That's just as dangerous, really.
And then Sean?
You want people to stand up, right?
Just introduce yourself. Well, I very much appreciated Matthew's presentation. My own thoughts on this are sort of in process of development. But one of the things I liked about what he was saying was that he was focusing on clarifying the lines of distinction rather than blurring them. Now, I'm not sure I agree with where he drew the lines, and he probably is not entirely sure of where he drew the lines. But the idea of being precise in drawing the lines is what I think is most important of all, even if sometimes we're not sure of that or we differ amongst ourselves in that. And as part of that, I even question the use of the categories of far right, right, center, moderate left, far left. I mean, these are categories that were born, what, in the Second French Republic in the 1830s, and I'm not sure how useful they are. Now, I don't have any better categories necessarily to suggest, but it seems to me what we do when we use these categories is we assume where people fall down on certain kinds of central questions which have historically defined these. For instance, support for social welfare programs or opposition to social welfare or that sort of thing. And I'm not sure that they carry. In my opinion, the most important political fact of the 20th century was the name of Hitler's party, the German National Socialist Workers' Party. What that means to me is it's not a foregone. Now, for instance, let me back up. I don't know for sure. There's a hardcore within the Trump movement, and I think it's roughly what Matthew defined it as, roughly. But to me, call that a platonic ideal, if you please. It's not clear to me that it's a given. People have been assuming, well, Trump's going to come out and roll back Social Security, and he's going to abolish public health care, and he's going to, well, I don't know what he's going to do. because he doesn't even know what he's going to do tomorrow, right? Right. Plus, there are various forces and acting on him, and who knows, he flips around and he speaks on both sides of it. What I'm really trying to say is that hardcore within that movement is not necessary. The assumption is he'll cut back unemployment compensation and shatter workers' wages. Well, maybe he will and maybe he won't. If he does that, our job is fairly easy. Lots of his supporters will come over to our side. But if he doesn't do that, or if he does it only partly, or if he does it in a way that maintains the plausibility of that he really is a popular candidate, then it's not going to, our predictions will not be fulfilled. And I question the use of this left-right terminology. I'm not sure it helps us. I don't have an alternative, but I'm not sure it helps us. Second is that I want to do that while being aware that people are not fixed at any moment. Many of the people in movements move from one to another, and it may be better not to try and fix them. In other words, I'm kind of what you're calling a dialectic, or maybe you might call it a schizophrenic approach. That is to say, it is important for us, those of us who consider ourselves to be conscious revolutionaries who make the decisions in our lives based on that goal, to be clear, we're focusing on the distinctions. On the other hand, we have to remember that millions of people in activity out there are not moving on that basis, and they're not focusing on the distinctions, and we may be find it useful to be aware of both things at the same time.
Thank you. Sean.
I wanted to thank you for the presentation, and I wanted to suggest that maybe it's not, we shouldn't adopt the alt-right's self-description of themselves as white nationalists. And because I think that we should say what they are. It's about white supremacists. And I think there's a slight difference in there. They sort of say, well, we're not racist, we just want our own nation, or they play around with these words. But it is about white supremacy. The United States is not a white nation. It's a white supremacist nation, but it's not a white nation. And I think that we should not, and I read in these times and some of the left progressive things where they talk about the white nationalists. And I don't think that we should buy into that, because I think it's about white supremacy, and I think that that's how we should describe it, and that's what we should say it's about. And we shouldn't just adopt their self-descriptions.
Can I respond? What? Can I respond?
Yes, but then I realize I've been looking too much towards this side.
Oh, okay.
Okay. But you get to respond.
Yeah. Just real quick, I mean, I see, and I think it's important to clarify this point, and so thank you for raising it. I see white nationalism as a subset. It's a specific form of white supremacist ideology. So it's not like it's a gentler form. And I say that because you can be a white supremacist and not support the idea of a white ethnostate. You know, if you support Jim Crow segregation, that's not white nationalism in that sense. But it's certainly white supremacist. So I would certainly agree that we should not give them a pass and say, well, if they say that all races are equal, I mean, they talk out of both sides of their mouth. So yes, but it, I see it as a specific version of that.
Okay, so people who over here were raising their hands, do it again. Whoa, okay. I'm not sure we're gonna have enough time for this, okay, because we're already running late. How about one, two, three? I didn't see your hand up before. Four. Let me stop right there. Oh, actually, I'm going to do five, okay? Let's stop there, and please, if you could, try to do it in 1 minute, okay? We have a bunch of things to attend to. Yes, please.
All right, so what I was going to say
you
is...
You might want to stand up. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, you might also want to step out over there, so you're not quite as...
And your name is?
My name is Cal, from Twin Cities. I was going to say that I think that whoever was speaking over here, was really right in that saying that a lot of the alt-right culture isn't necessarily at its core one that upholds white supremacy as much as you might see on the surface. I think a lot of it is upholding like subversion of content, and you see a lot of this, especially when you take into account where they're organizing, right? They're organizing on the internet, and a lot of this really comes from the 80s hacker culture, where like a lot of what at the core they're trying to express is subversion of of systems or finding clever solutions for things, right? And I see that a lot of in the alt-right, the tactics that they use really come from, like, the concerted tactics of Chanology, first of all, in 2008, which is prior to this, online movements didn't necessarily happen in structured, concerted ways, right? But then those same tactics were adopted to Gamergate, which is a lot of the time something that I consider to be one of the first, you know, alt-right harassment campaigns.
Yes.
So I think that we need to be really critical about, you know, as we consider what is the core value of the alt-right or the alt-light, as you would call them, in one that really upholds subversion or upholds white supremacy at its core, and we can use this to counter-organize as well.
Okay, next one.
Hi, my name is Emmett Doyle, M1 and the IWW and GDC.
Yeah, people don't know what M1 is.
Pay First Anarchist Alliance. I think that one of the things we need to realize about the alt-right and why they act the way they do in relation to certain questions is because white nationalists at this time in history believe they've already lost, more or less. They believe that we're currently living under a globalist system and that there's a liberal PC establishment. So when we're thinking, why are they the ones who are trolling and being all subversive? Because they actually do see themselves as subversive. The way they look at it, we already live in this liberal elite PC culture, and that they don't have power. If we're wondering why they view themselves as white nationalist instead of necessarily white supremacists, it's because they believe that, a lot of them believe that that might be a lost cause, that seceding into a white ethno-state is kind of their only hope. And if we look at why, for example, some of the fascist movements here in the U.S. no longer adhere to the classical fascism strong central state, but have moved into these decentralized forms, this idea of the ethno-state. Why, for example, the silver shirts back in the 70s became posse comitatus and this militia movement, and taking all this decentralist rhetoric, is again because they believe that they are anti-establishment now, because they believe that globalists, in their words, have won, and because they believe that they're subverting the PC culture.
Thank you. Zach, were you number three?
Yeah, quick question. So,
made the cut.
My name's Zach. Lots of people here. So my question is, to what extent is there a truth in the notion, or maybe where are the limits of the idea that any exposure or any publicity is good publicity? Because I think, you know, you look, it seems like this is kind of an idea that's on the alt-right. You know, if you look back in Mein Kampf, Hitler talks about this. He's like, it doesn't matter if we're exposed as criminals or clowns in the press. The point is to get as much press as possible, project an image of strength. I think we can see that with Trump's rise in terms of publicity. You know, I don't know, maybe it makes no difference, but Milo, after the thing at Berkeley, the sales of his book, you know, shot up 12,000%. So I'm just wondering about, like, that in terms of strategy or tactics.
Any quick rejoinder to that, Matthew?
Well, I mean, we could have a much bigger discussion about it, but I would say one thing is that the alt-right has not needed the left to get its message out. It's had good success on its own and with the help of more mainstream friends on the right.
Okay, and then, yes.
Hi. Well, I'm wondering, I'm talking to you.
Yes, say who you are.
My name is Naomi Brussel. Hi. I'm wondering whether what you see in terms of so-called women's issues and women being involved in this kind of theoretical discussion. I'm very kind of startled to see how predominantly white and male this group is. You know, and that it seems to me sometimes that the theoretical discussions are going on between cis men arguing with each other about, and kind of not noticing that there are other people existing on the earth. So I'm just wondering, what do you think about the kind of exclusion of women and what you described as the alt-right's perspective, and the exclusion of women in some other theoretical discussions such as this one? I'm not saying that this one is excluding women, but I'm just saying it's the exclusiveness of men talking.
Thank you.
Speaking as a man, I mean, it's you know, whatever I say is going to be from a limited point of view. I mean, I think that, one of the other folks a moment ago mentioned Gamergate, which, as people may recall, is a campaign that kind of blew up a couple of years ago to target in a very vicious way women who were active in relation to the online gaming community, computer gaming. And this I raise it because it is very much tied in with the alt-right, and it's a struggle where women, not only women, but certainly women, played a leading role in fighting back. And I think that drawing connections between that specific struggle and the kind of struggle against online misogyny, which is pervasive, is another element that needs to be connected in. That, people focus a lot on white nationalism or white supremacy when they're talking about the alt-right. We need to emphasize the misogynistic character, which is central, and make those connections.
Okay,
can I say, yes? Well, I was just going to ask, my name is Jihan.
After, say your name again.
Jihan. No, it was very informative, but I wanted to know more about what do you think the establishment's relationship is going to be to them moving forward? Because you're talking about, traditionally, at least, maybe not in the U.S., but I understood fascism was to be more state and authoritarian-oriented, right? And you're saying there's like a very strong libertarian decentralization aspect to it, and then they themselves see the administration as something to work with, to spread their ideas, but ultimately their goal is different, right? So do you see those tensions? First, I'm wondering what the establishment thinks of them at the moment, right? Because maybe they were useful towards the election campaign, and now do you think their differences will come to a head? And second, whether what they maybe see their timeline of that expiring and them organizing as an independent force more and more towards their actual goal?
I don't really have answers since we're looking forward, but I think these are really important questions to raise and for us all to keep in mind going forward. I mean, I think that somebody like Bannon sees, the alt-right as useful in the way that, this sort of dynamic tension. They're kind of out there being outrageous, and it makes it easier for, even somebody like Bannon to sound reasonable by comparison. So as long as that doesn't result in head-on conflict over specific policies, whether it's over Israel or other issues, then I think that can continue. But it may be that at a certain point they will just get, there will be too much conflict and think there'll be a falling out. And it looks like.
Okay, we're going to cut it off, okay? People will get another chance. Thank you very much, Matthew. Okay? So the board is here. We probably have, again, a few more people than we have food for, but we'll try to sort that out. The food is in the room next to us. What I'd like to ask is one of our stalwart members to stand at the door to the food with a hat in hand, being $5 and $20.
I changed my mind about it.